Hi, I'm Lise Wheel, and this is Wheel of Justice. Last time on Wheel of Justice, I told you about Adeline Wilford, who was murdered in her home in Maryland on January 5th, 1987. Despite looking at many suspects, some 27, police officers had no real lead for years. In fact, it wasn't until 2000 that there was any real progress in the case. And as you might recall, it was in 2000 when Beverly Hadaway met with Maryland State Police officers John Bollinger and Jack McCauley. She told them that she'd seen her nephew, Jonathan Smith, Ray Andrews, and David Faulkner fleeing from the scene of the crime in 1987. She said she was driving on Black Dog Alley Road, a road she seldom traveled, when she saw Jonathan, Ray, and David emerge from a cornfield near the crime. Beverly noticed that Jonathan had blood on him. It looked like he'd been sprayed with blood, she said. Jonathan's explanation was that it was blood from a dog he had recently killed for biting him. So in 2000, Beverly agreed to wear a hidden microphone while trying to get Jonathan, her nephew, to confess. And as I told you last time, he did. This led to the subsequent arrests of three men. Essentially, without Beverly Hadaway, who died in 2008, there's no case. So who was this woman? Why would she agree to try to get her own nephew to incriminate himself? First, let's start with who she was. As you likely gathered from the last episode, and as you'll hear in this one, Ms. Hadaway was a colorful character with a mouth of a sailor. I've listened to hours of her talking about this case, and I still can't describe her in three words or less. A lot of the time, she seems angry. She yells, and she cusses, and she threatens. And then on a dime, she's laughing and joking around. She seems to have a lot of knowledge about the people in her area, and she loves to gossip. And she's cunning. She knew she had information that cops wanted, and she expected everything but the kitchen sink in exchange for her cooperation. And I can't really paint a clear picture of this woman without also telling you that she'd had a few brushes with the law. In 1975, she pled guilty to receiving stolen goods in excess of $100. She received 3 years in prison for that. Also on her rap sheet, burglary with intent to steal, misuse of a telephone, inducing a minor to truancy, and refusing to return a leased car. She was also a fugitive in a case against another woman for forging checks. The story goes that Beverly used threats to coerce the other woman to write two bad checks. But none of this really explains why she was so heavily involved in this case. I mean, what motivated her to the point of putting her nephew behind bars? As far as I'm concerned, her abrasive, perhaps even devious personality doesn't provide an answer. But the defense teams for Jonathan and David have a few ideas. They say one motive was certainly exchanging her cooperation for drop charges. Remember how I told you in the last episode that she first came forward in 1994? Interestingly enough, Beverly's son was arrested about that time, and she wanted to help him by providing info about Adeline's death. But nothing really came of that. That didn't stop her from coming around again. She wanted something for her help. Specifically, she wanted narcotics charges against her grandson, Landon Janda, dropped. A little quid pro quo, if you will. You see, Landon was charged in September of 2000 with multiple narcotics offenses, including possession of controlled substances with an intent to distribute. And Beverly wanted no record of these charges at all. In fact, audio between her and Sergeant John Bollinger, who was the lead investigator for the case, shows just how far the lovely Beverly would go to get what she wanted.
I want that mother to say that Landon Janda will not be prosecuted on any and all charges. I also want them to know that after the first trial, they are going to immediately hand me a paper before I testify in the second and third that says that he has total immunity. That means that an all process, hey, I can go in there and testify three times and they can bring the charges right back up on him. And you know what? I know they're f***ing common enough to try it, but I want an insurance policy. Now,
there's so the only thing you're looking for this time is the null price of the charges. Right?
Look, I want that he'll have no charges, that his charges will be dropped. I don't care if they go in there and say, Your Honor, I want it off his f***ing record. But the first time, I'll take no process. The second time I go in that damn courtroom, before I go in that door, they can go in there to Horn and say, Your Honor, we know for a fact that this is wrong, and we want him found not guilty, and we want this record expunged. Because I don't want to go in there and do my thing three times, and then they say, hey, we'll bring him up later. Or me go in there and do my damn part, and they say, now that bitch was so damn hard making us type a letter, and it took two minutes of our time, and we actually had to do work. Now we're going to get her back. We're going to arrest him again.
Right.
We're not playing them damn games.
All right, so it's a compromise you're asking for.
The compromise is simple. It's the same f***ing thing I told you the day he got arrested.
But you want
they can go in that damn courtroom this afternoon and tell Judge Horn to drop the charges and not to charge him with anything. It's come to light through detectives. Tamper that somebody else did it and confessed to it. Beautiful. I'll do anything the rest of my life that you ask me to do. If you want to know something you don't know and I know, ask my f***ing ass. I'll tell you I enjoy every minute of it. I enjoy going out and digging up f***ing records. I enjoy knowing I know more than the cops do. And I enjoy the contacts that I have. And you'll be amazed at all the ones I have. Because I have my own f***ing spy ring. How in the hell do you think that I find out what they do almost the minute they think it? That's called outthinking your opponent.
In another audio from February 2, 2001, Bollinger tells Beverly that the assistant state's attorney handling her grandson's case has refused to drop the charges. And Beverly responds, as you might expect her to, by threatening to testify in a way that would result in Jonathan, Ray, and David walking free.
You can go get the newspaper to start printing. Three people found innocent. And I've got just one little piece of paper, and it can all be had with one word that nobody knows. But I know, and I got the paper, and I got the proof. And one word, just one word out of the English language, will let all three of them walk. And for my grandson, you don't think I'll use that f***ing word? I won't.
She then goes to the police station to continue her conversation with Bollinger. And she threatened to testify to her own mental illness if charges weren't dropped against her grandson, which would essentially mean her story, which was a spark for the whole case, would be worthless. So she not only bargained hard for her grandson's charges to be dropped, she also threatened to change her story if her demands weren't met. Can you really trust a person who's willing to change her story if there's no benefit for her? Especially when there'd really been no case without her? The second motive is money. In the last episode, I told you that Adeline's son offered $25,000 reward in exchange for information related to his mother's murder. Before I talk about Beverly's award-related problems, let me tell you a little bit more about this reward. Charles Curry Wilford, the son of Mrs. Wilford, acting on behalf of the family of Adeline, authorized the Maryland State Police to publicly offer a reward of $10,000. An additional $15,000 was offered if the information led to a conviction. The evidence shows that Beverly knew about this award money before she went to the cops in 2000, and she did get part of that reward. In June of 2000, 1 month after Jonathan, David, and Ray were arrested, Beverly was paid $10,000 in reward money. As for the other 15, that's where things get interesting. About a month before Beverly was to testify in the trial against Jonathan, good old Mrs. Hadway sent a demand letter to Adeline's family and to the Maryland State Police for the additional money. According to the letter, Charles Wilford and the Maryland State Police were jointly and severally liable for the remaining $15,000. Her reasoning was that a contract was formed. There was an offer to provide a reward. Beverly provided what was asked for and thus accepted the offer. So she felt she had a right to the remainder of the reward, and she threatened to sue if she didn't get it, which is exactly what she did. On February 22, 2001, she brought a suit demanding the $15,000 and an additional $25,000 in punitive damages. So I think you could safely say that Beverly Hadaway had her eye on this reward. Maybe the money and her grandson's clean record were just secondary motives. Perhaps Miss Hadaway just wanted justice for Adeline, and so she came forward and decided that while she was at it, she'd get all she could for her cooperation. But you at least have to question her credibility, right? Beyond her questionable motives, there are also some odd things to consider. Well, there are a lot of things that are odd about Beverly Hadaway, but these are specific to this case. First, let's talk about a man named Grayson Eckel. This was an attorney who played multiple roles in this case. He was the defense attorney for Landon Janda, Beverly's grandson. He was the attorney for Lacey Janda, Beverly's daughter, in a probate proceeding. He briefly represented Beverly in her suit related to the award money. Oh, and did I mention that he also represented Ray Andrews, one of the men supposedly involved in the murder? This is a man with his hand in a lot of things, all seemingly related and all by one common thread, Beverly Hadaway. It actually came to light that for whatever reason, he was providing police reports and crime scene photos to his friend Beverly, which you might surmise gave Hadaway all of the tools she would need to come up with the accurate testimony implicating Jonathan, David, and Ray. So out of curiosity, I checked Maryland's attorney registry. Not surprisingly, Mr. Eckel's law license has been suspended as a result of convictions for assault, sexual offense, and false imprisonment. Good old Bev also paid a visit to Ray Andrews while he was in jail awaiting trial. Now, why would she do this? To wish him well or to feed him a certain account of the story? And finally, there are inconsistencies in Beverly's story. For example, she made statements to the police about what she witnessed on the day of the crime, statements which changed over the course of the investigation, including who she was with when she saw the three men in the field, where she was going, and what her purpose was for driving on a back road. In her initial statement to the police, she claimed she'd been in a car with her friend Thomas Marshall. When Mr. Marshall did not confirm her story, Ms. Hadaway told the police that she misremembered the date and instead been with her friend Susan Fitzhugh. She also initially told the police that she was on her way to Glen Burnie, Maryland, when she saw the boys. However, police followed up on her story and discovered that on that date in question, she'd not been in Glenbury, Maryland, but rather in Chestertown, Maryland. When confronted with this fact, Ms. Hadaway again changed her story and told police she went to Chestertown to trade goods from her store. Beverly also tried to explain many other inconsistencies, such as changes in her description of the clothes worn by Smith and Andrews, by claiming that she wrote down her story incorrectly. The whole case gained steam because of this woman's story. What do you think? After all I've told you, would you believe her? Would you put three men behind bars for murder based on her testimony? Next time on Wheel of Justice, I'm going to talk about something that's bothered me ever since I started looking at this case. And that's the confessions from both Jonathan and Ray. Why would these two confess to a crime they didn't commit? Tune in to find out. Till next time, I'm Lise Wheel for Wheel of Justice.